Okay, good morning, everyone. If we can just make sure all the phones are turned off, would be great. Look, firstly, thank you for very much for joining us for the 2019 full year results webcast, and it's a pleasure to be here with you, and thank you for joining us in person, also those people through the World Wide Web. Today is an end of an era, and it's the beginning of a new chapter for Allsearch, being the first time in really 25 years that Peter Botten isn't delivering the full year results. It was Peter's last day as Managing Director yesterday, but importantly, he's still involved with the company, and in actual fact, he's working in PNG at the moment with Beth, and I'll get onto that a little bit more shortly. Allsearch has become a multi-dimensional entity with world-class assets and performance from our PNG LNG Foundation project. We've got mature but still very valuable PNG oil production, and we're still working with our joint venture partners to advance the PNG LNG expansion and Papua LNG projects. In addition, our investment in Alaska is turning out very, very well. We've had significant resource upgrades, material progress in Alaska with the Pickerel development and negotiations there, as well as recent exploration success, which Bruce will go through in the presentation. In this climate, economic climate, with a number of firm growth projects, we're very, very focused on capital prioritisation, capital management, driving our costs into the lowest quartile, and ensuring we deliver superior results and value for our shareholders. Clearly, the last 6 months has been challenging for all of us, with the uncertainty on the PNG LNG expansion, the global economy related to coronavirus, and we're seeing what that's been doing to markets over the last 2 days. And importantly, PNG is not an orphan. The slowdown has impacted most projects globally, and it's also provided us a window of opportunity for continuing progress with our projects. I'll leave the disclaimer for you to read at your leisure, obviously that has to be part of every presentation. Importantly, for those who are present today, there are no planned emergencies, so if we hear alarms, this will be a real event. There's a cascading series of alertness that begins with a warden advising us over the PA that there is an issue. If it increases to a beep, beep, beep over the PA system, at that stage, the warden will ask us to follow any instructions, and if it really cascades quickly to a whoop, 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 then we will evacuate the auditorium immediately following the warden's directions. You'll follow the exit is through the exit at the back of the stage, and if you can make sure that you follow to the muster area at the junction of Young and Bent Streets, and please don't wander off because people will be looking for you and we don't want to create any issues. Now getting on to the agenda of today's presentation. Really, going forward, it's really my intention for you all to meet all of our senior executives who are responsible for core areas of the business. But today, in the interest of time, I'll cover the highlights, safety and social responsibility before handing over to Stephen Gardner, our CFO, who many of you know will cover the financial overview. It was our intention for Beth White, who until recently was responsible for the gas and developments, but following the integration of the LNG expansion into the PNG Business Unit, is now our new President of PNG Business Unit, and she is actually currently, as I said, up in Papua New Guinea with Peter, facilitating ongoing discussions related to the LNG expansion. So I'll cover Beth's areas in the presentation. I'm also very pleased to introduce you to Bruce Dingeman, who's President of our Alaska BU, and he'll cover all things Alaska, which is proceeding very well. And then I'll wrap up with our strategic review objectives for 2020. We also have Diego Fetwais here in the first aisle, and he's our acting vice president in charge, executive vice president in charge of commercial strategies and also in charge of gas marketing. And Diego and I went around Asia, particularly in Japan last week, talking to our markets, so we're very clear and knowledgeable on exactly where the markets are and where PNG sits in that process. But firstly, I'll start off with the operational highlights, and Stephen will go into more detail, but this really captures the highlights for 2019. Our NPAT for the year was $312.4 million, which was down 8% on 2018, and is primarily a result of the lower oil and gas prices realised, and also the adoption of the new IFRS accounting standards, and Stephen will go through that. Our total production across our LNG and our operated oil assets was 27.9 million barrels of oil equivalent, which was at the lower end of the guidance and primarily due to the outage of our oil production and capping of the LNG in September due to the Carnboy incident, which necessitated the fixing of one of the five chains. I'm very pleased to say that issue has now been fully resolved. PNG produced at an annualised rate of 8.5 million tonnes per annum, and production was impacted by planned downtime in the first half, and also, as I just said, during loading during the fixing of the Carnboy in the second half. We focused the loading on the PNG LNG project and reduced and cut back the oil production to ensure that LNG offtake was impacted as minimally as possible. We have had incredibly positive resource upgrades with a 96% increase in our 2P and 2C reserves, primarily driven by Alaska, and Bruce will cover that in more detail. We've also had an increasing focus on unit operating costs, and for 2019 we averaged $12.48, and that included all the upstream pipeline and liquefaction costs. We continue to be a strong supporter of community projects, and we are very pleased to announce that we're paying 4.5 cents a share, taking the full-year dividend to 9.5 cents per share, which represents a 46% payout ratio, which is at the top end of our range. Moving on to safety. We started off the year, if you remember, from Peter's presentation back in August, talking about the first half-year results with a less than stellar safety performance. I'm very pleased to say that the team in Papua New Guinea and Alaska has very much turned that around. In the second half of the year, we were able to achieve significant improvements in safety, which was driven by increased engagement and oversight of our seismic operations in Papua New Guinea. We're acquiring seismic and land acquisitions in probably one of the most challenging environments in the world, and we've also changed to a new contract, but this was no excuse for the safety incidents we saw. We modified our own management oversight, and we're very now pleased with the commitment of all involved. Safety performance in all other areas of the business has been world-class, which is especially pleasing considering the extensive activities in Alaska. I was in Alaska 2 weeks ago, and the temperatures on the North Slope were minus 50. So these are incredible conditions in which to operate. If you move forward to our reserves and resources, we've had a very, very positive increase in our corporate resource base in 2019, as I said, with reserves and resources rising 96% to 497 million barrels, while 2P and 2C gas resources have also increased 17% to 1,682 million barrels of oil equivalent. The 243.6 million barrel increase in Alaska 2C resource was related to an additional 116 million barrels following technical work, including the 2019 appraisal wells, and that was confirmed by our independent auditor, Ryder Scott. There was also 127 million barrels increase related to our exercising of the option in July last year of the Armstrong GMT option following our confirmation of the positive results of the original drilling. Based on 2019 production, it was 27.9 million barrels. Our 1P reserves life is 15 years. Our 2P reserves life is 17 years. And our 2P and 2C resource life is 60 years. We now have an incredible solar platform with significant further additions in both regions. But all such is very, very well placed with respect to our resource base supporting our growth long term. I just want to show the management team, because there's been a number of changes, some very positive changes that have occurred in our management team, and these have been in preparation for Peter's succession. We undertook a major review of the optimum business model that saw us go to a business unit with clear accountabilities and capital management, as well as ensuring that the leadership had the right balance and focus to deliver on our potential in a changing world. We've really struck the balance of younger, more dynamic professionals with more experienced executives who have a greater relevant international experience with enhanced accountabilities in the business unit model, with corporate centre being focused on strategy, capital management and capability. We have a great balance team, and I'm very excited to work with this group to drive the assets forward in a coordinated manner, very focused on capital efficiency. The next slide relates to our social licence and responsibility, and its links to ESG. And this is something that is at the core of the DNA in Oil Search. We believe that it's not only the right thing to do, but it's a clear differentiator relative to our peers in the energy industry. It's especially in an industry that's being required to be held to a higher socio-environmental standard than ever before. We're looking to build on our social responsibility skills to continue to be a leader in this area. As everyone's aware, we've been a major socio-economic contributor in PNG for many years, and we continue to provide multiple services in health, education, power, infrastructure across PNG, both directly and through our Oil Search Foundation. Going forward, as part of our strategic review, we'll actually look to see how we evolve our community engagement and support in PNG to reflect the changing dynamic and focus on long-term capability building of PNG entities. The same corporate ethos has been applied in Alaska, and we've quickly been recognised as a leader in community engagement there. And importantly, it's reflected in how quickly we've got the community to support our projects and get our necessary approvals to progress our field operations. In Alaska, we signed long-term access agreements that have benefit sharing and support for local corporations, as well as building long-term sustainable businesses with a major focus on long-term community well-being that transcends and goes beyond the period of oil production and also looking at opportunity creation for future generations. It's been a fantastic outcome of collaboration with the local community there. The growing focus globally on climate change presents challenges but also presents opportunities for us. Our extensive gas portfolio with infrastructure is ideally placed to support long-term transition, and our proposed oil developments adjacent to existing facilities ensure that we're in the lowest cost for new developments. It is a core tenet for any growth that we are focused on in oil search. We've also established dedicated carbon reduction teams to minimise emissions and our environmental footprint. This occurs across the company and is being led by our corporate. When combined with one of our initiatives, being the potential biomass project in PNG, where we've already planted over 4 million trees, it has the potential to offset over 4 million tonnes of CO2 over its 25-year project life. To put that into context, it's equivalent to offsetting the Pikka development over that period. AllSearch is focused on developing tangible initiatives to align our company with the expectations of our shareholders and financiers. This is a core area of focus for our strategic review, which will look to position AllSearch as a leader in the social enviro responsibility to make AllSearch a preferred choice for shareholders, investors and joint venture partners. We test our business on all climate change scenarios, and our current business is very robust on the 2018 Climate Change Resilient Report, which indicates long-term resilience in a 2 degrees Celsius world. In 2019, we also commenced detailed baselining and carbon mapping across our entire business, which will be the basis for prioritising our initiatives. Our commitment to operate sustainably to date has also been recognised globally by several international institutions, which are listed on the slide. I'm going to hand over to Stephen, who will go through the financial performance, and then we'll move over to Bruce.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and let me add my congratulations to Kieran on taking the helm. I'm very excited to work with Kieran. I've known him for many years, and I think he's going to do a fantastic job of leading this company forward. So let me provide a quick whirlwind tour through the financial performance of the company. As Kieran mentioned, our net profit was down on the prior year, down, in fact, by $29 million due to a number of factors. One of them was the introduction of a new lease accounting standard in 2019. The net overall impact of that was a reduction in our profit of $11 million. I'll highlight some of the other areas that's impacted our components of our financial results as I walk you through the waterfall chart that highlights some of the other key drivers. Our production and sales volumes for the year increased by 11%, which was good news, mostly from the PNG LNG project delivering a record production for the year. However, revenue was only up 3%, or $49 million US dollars. It was held back by an 11% decline in realised liquids prices and a 5% decline in gas and LNG prices. Our production costs were 20% higher on 2018, and I'll cover those reasons in a lot more detail on the next slide. We also had higher depreciation and amortisation, driven not only by increased LNG production, but also a $29 million US dollar depreciation of assets that were brought on the balance sheet for the first time as part of the new leasing standard. We enjoyed lower exploration costs expensed compared to the prior year, really in line with lower exploration activity in Papua New Guinea. Our effective tax rate, just over 30%, was in line with the PNG corporate tax rate. We did have some other positive impacts on net profit, largely due to higher joint venture recoveries on capitalised assets, some insurance recoveries related to prior year work that we couldn't book against those costs but had to take as other income, And offsetting that, though, was a small write-down of leases that we relinquished during the year, both in Papua New Guinea and Alaska. Now, turning to our production costs, as mentioned, our production costs were higher both in absolute terms and on a unit basis, impacted by a number of one-off factors, such as the residual effects of the 2018 earthquake and the loading buoy damage that occurred in August last year. The loading buoy repair and preventative maintenance costs incurred in the second half of the year were spread across all of our projects, including PNG LNG. Our insurance recoveries were booked in 2019 only against work done by the PNG LNG project on earthquake repairs. We weren't able to book any recoveries against the ongoing remediation work that we did in the oil fields, unlike 2018. Our oil projects also undertook higher maintenance and production optimisation work programs during 2019, including activities carried over from 2018 that were delayed due to the disruption from the earthquake. Normalising for those issues does show a better unit cost position, but not an acceptable one. And as Kieran's mentioned, we're very focused on identifying opportunities to reduce our operated oil and gas production costs. We need to ensure that these operations are sustainable over a longer term, and it's a very high priority for 2020 to bring those costs down. Moving on to our cash and liquidity position, we generated just over $750 million of operating cash flow in the year, again supported by a very solid contribution from PNG LNG. Of that amount, $363 million was invested across a successful Alaskan appraisal drilling program and Pika pre-feed activities, completion of the Muruk 2 appraisal well, acquisition of seismic data in both PNG and Alaska, oilfield development and exploration drilling, progression of LNG expansion activities, and ongoing implementation of our ERP program. We also used that money to repay $354 million of PNG LNG project finance debt, and also returned $206 million to our shareholders in the form of dividends. As Kieran mentioned, the Armstrong option exercise and alignment arrangement with Repsol resulted in a net cash outlay of $386 million during the second half of the year. The result of that was to double our interest in the main Alaskan licences. In summary, the overall liquidity position at the end of the year was $1.15 billion, including cash of just over $400 million. The proposed sell-down of about 15 percentage points of Alaskan license interest acquired under the Armstrong option is now planned to occur in the second half of this year, closer to the FID for the Pika development. That will certainly help rebuild our liquidity position later in the year. And finally, just returning to the full-year guidance, our production and operating cost guidance ranges are unchanged from those that we released in the December quarterly report in late January. And Kieran will provide some more colour on the production outlook, so I'll focus on CapEx guidance. Our CapEx guidance range, excluding the impact of any Alaskan licence sell-down interests, is necessarily very wide at this point. We're showing a low of around $700 million to a high of $850 million. Reflects the current uncertainty we're facing on the timing of moving into FEED and or FID on our expansion projects in PNG in particular and also Alaska. For PNG, until we have that certainty, we'll be controlling our spend on growth activities, particularly until we have clear line of sight on progressing a three-train integrated LNG expansion. But that spend, once we do have that line of sight, can be ramped up very quickly. Production CapEx guidance includes a Kudubu development well we hope to spud in March, production enhancing well workovers, work on rebuilding our refinery that was severely damaged by the earthquake, and ongoing reliability and risk reduction programs. Our development spend largely relates to the Pika development, including major early works and long lead item commitments, with FID targeted in the second half of this year. It also includes a ramp up of Ngore field development activities this year. And finally, our exploration and evaluation includes two Alaskan exploration wells that are currently underway, the unfortunately unsuccessful Gobi footwall well, seismic acquisition in both PNG and Alaska, and a considerable pre-feed and feed expenditures to progress the Pikka unit development and also LNG expansion in PNG. And on that note, I'll hand back to Kieran. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Stephen. Beth White, who is our president of our PNG business unit, was going to present this, but as I said, she's in doing more important things in Papua New Guinea at the moment, so you'll have to bear with me. In terms of the production 2019, you know, we're finally getting in on top of the impact of the earthquake in 2018, which actually took a lot longer than originally planned to get on top of. 2019 production of 27.9 million barrels of oil equivalent was 11% higher than 2018 when it was impacted by the earthquake, but still we were impacted by the Carnboy incident in the third quarter. Our 2019 highlights included the 8.5 million tonnes average rate, which is the highest in startup, but importantly we recorded a daily record of 9.25 million tonnes per annum equivalent for the project. The swift and efficient response by the oil search recovery team, together with excellent collaboration with the PNG LNG operator, allowed us to fix the Carnboy and subsequent repairs as quick as possible, but it did mean that the impact on PNG LNG production was minimised and full production was restored well ahead of the initial expectations. The company's oil production continued to be impacted by the prolonged return to service following the earthquake, but by year end, and as you'll see in 2020, we've completed a substantial amount of this work, and we've had successfully completed, and production is now ramping up, especially being boosted by the successful recent workovers and drilling operations which were undertaken during the latter part of the year. In regard to our oil searches operated fields, we've successfully completed workovers and two development wells in Kutubu and Moran, and that's been achieved with excellent safety record with no recordable instances. We've actually added over 10 million barrels gross, which is 6 million barrels net incremental oil volumes, and they're currently contributing about 4,500 barrels a day gross or 2,500 barrels a day net. And probably most pleasing was the costs were 10% below AFE. The Moran development well M15 Sidetrack 2 also commenced production in January 2020 at very encouraging rates, and the Kutubu development well and UDT 15 has also commenced production in January 20, also at good rates. Moving forward, we still have the Kutubu development wells, despite in first quarter 20, which is targeting the Agafu Reservoir. We have a core tubing program in the second half of 2020, which is targeting cost-effective and incremental production at Moran and Gogo. We are only allocating capital to those projects that have rapid paybacks and are robust at low oil prices. In regard to the 2020 production outlook, overall our production is expected to be similar to 2019, despite scheduled maintenance on one of the LNG trains in the second quarter 2020. In regard to our operator production, where we've substantially and successfully ramped up production in the first quarter this year, we're now achieving rates over 15,000 barrels a day. We still have not been able to access the northwest Moran area, which is limiting our production, but plans are certainly underway to access the area and recommence production by year end, and these are obviously subject to landowner approvals and access. We've taken the opportunity post the earthquake to really look at our reliability across all of our facilities, a program to understand where the key reliability issues are and their root causes, and a path to establish operational excellence has been in progress since early 2019. And we're now seeing the strong production ramp up towards the end of last year and early this year, which is encouraging in that respect. In regard to our non-operated production, obviously the PNG LNG production is forecast to be somewhere between 8.3 and 8.5 million tonnes per annum, and that allows for the rate reductions to accommodate the scheduled turbine and pipeline maintenance. So our total net production guidance for the year of 2020 is in the range of 27.5 to 29.5 million barrels of oil equivalent. Just going to now touch on, again, Beth would have covered this section in terms of the gas development and PNG exploration, but Diego and I, as I said earlier, had the pleasure of going through our markets over the last 2 weeks and talking to a number of our customers. So, you know, we're actually very well placed to be able to deal with this section. As everyone aware, As everyone is aware, the pathway to moving forward on PNG LNG expansion and the Papua LNG projects has been challenging over the last 8 months. Whilst the Papua Gas Agreement had been signed and approved by the PNG government, the Pnyang Gas Agreement has not been agreed and formal negotiations were suspended at the end of January. Importantly, informal discussions are ongoing to find a resolution to the differences and all parties acknowledge the considerable value and savings associated with an integrated three-train project, especially in the current global economic environment and oversupply of gas projects. Both Exxon and Total have publicly stated that they remain focused on finding a solution. And as I indicated earlier, Peter and Beth are both in PNG this week continuing informal discussions exploring solutions to the current impasse. PNG's proximity to growing markets in Asia and its advantage over other suppliers in terms of cost, its high heating value, the fact that this is effectively a brownfield expansion means that PNG LNG really remains a high priority for all stakeholders and we're still working to find a mutually acceptable solution for it to proceed. This slide really demonstrates the considerable success and progress that's been achieved in advancing the PNG expansion over 2019, which allows the projects to move smoothly into FEED on the basis of getting an agreeable Pnyang gas agreement. Clearly, that's the priority right now, and finding a solution which is acceptable to all parties on benefit sharing is a priority. Everyone is very aware of the market and the supply, the LNG projects trying to secure contracts for their LNG. But this slide actually is an important one because it really just shows in great detail just how niche the PNG LNG and how superior it is relative to others for getting into the Japan market. As I said earlier, I've just returned from a marketing trip and where I've met senior executives in Japan and we were really encouraged by the feedback that we got from the people there. It also highlighted the uniqueness of PNG's gas relative to other suppliers, given our proximity to market, low regional security issues, high heating value gas and ideal specs for power generation. There is a continued very high level of interest in participating and securing LNG for our PNG expansion projects in the 2025 timeframe. This slide shows just how niche PNG LNG is relative to other volumes coming to the market. Most of the new volumes are substantially leaner with a lower heating value than PNG. This is shown on the graph on the left, which displays the relative heating value for the various LNG suppliers worldwide. It highlights just how well PNG LNG and indeed with Papua LNG, or even though it's a little bit leaner, is still materially higher than the majority of the gas coming to market. The gas on the right shows the lower heating value gas increasing in supply relative to the availability of higher heating gas through to 2025, and it really does highlight why the Japanese markets particularly are still very focused on PNG LNG as a viable option. When you combine these with the materially shorter transportation distances, and the fact that PNG LNG expansion and Papua LNG are predominantly brownfield expansions utilising existing downstream facilities, the PNG LNG expansion is very well placed. Moving forward into PNG exploration. Exploration spend going forward in PNG will be limited until there's clarity on the fiscal terms following the completion of the government's review on the fiscal terms for the Oil and Gas Act. Importantly, our 2020 activity is limited to completing our existing seismic obligations and activity around Muruk. And as I said, any future activity will be focused in the near term on the eastern fold belt areas where recent seismic supports very good prospectivity for gas east of the Antelope area. In 2020, we'll be processing and interpreting the seismic that's been acquired over the area during the last two field seasons to determine the viability of any future drilling activity. Due to our recent high levels over the past few years, we have very limited firm commitments and we don't need to drill any further wells to support PNG LNG expansion, so we're in a very good place to control our exploration spend. I'm now going to hand over to Bruce Dingeman, who will cover the Alaskan assets.
Thank you, Kieran. This introductory slide includes a quote from Wood Mackenzie, and it talks about Oil Search becoming a reliable operator in the region of Alaska. And it's really an affirmation of our progress since assuming operatorship in March 2018. The arc of oil search's progress in Alaska has really been quite remarkable. Since assuming operatorship, we are in our second season of drilling, with early and civil works now underway. I'd like to now shift gears and talk a little bit about some specific 2019 highlights and accomplishments. We've built a quality Alaska team. We've had a successful 2018-19 appraisal program entering the year. This was our Pikka B and C wells. Completion of the Pikka appraisal really indicates that all future drilling will be development in nature in the core field area. Exiting 2019, we'll have a two-rig program as well that's currently in progress with the Mitka and Stirrup wells. We've engaged in civil works totaling 40 kilometers of gravel and pads, and this early civil works will be a key part of our early production system. In addition to this, we've done these activities while performing exemplary safety and environmentally. Moving on, Karen mentioned earlier the resource increase, which was basically from 500 million gross to 728 million gross, which is underpinned by a reserve report from Ryder Scott. This represents a 46% increase in gross 2C volumes and excludes the potential from our Horseshoe and other areas where we're doing exploration activities. The next point speaks to our land use agreement with the community landowner. This is a life of field surface access agreement, and it assures a sustainable future for all stakeholders. In addition, we've had several regulatory milestones and approvals that we've met. We spoke earlier about the Armstrong option. This is where we increased our working interest from 25.5% to 51%. In addition, we aligned interest in our common holdings with Repsol at a 41-49% working interest share, respectively. We also realized a key record of decision from the U.S. Corps of Engineers. On the heels of this, we had a North Slope Master Plan rezone approval, which was granted to allow us to conduct our civil works this winter. And then we had a plethora of approvals from the state and other regulatory agency for our 2019 and 20 exploration and drilling programs. Additionally, we're maximizing cooperation with offset operators. We've had key data exchanges on subsurface information. We've done a number of community initiatives and involving both our Alaska Native corporations and villages, and have focused in the areas of contracting and community support. Our FEED activities are underway, and we continue to target FID in the second half of this year. Finally, on this slide, another key activity is that we've commenced our divestment process, seeking to sell down 15% working interest share, and have had positive initial response from the market in that regard. So moving on to our Pikka unit development, as mentioned previously, we're targeting the 728 million barrels in the core development area from the three drill sites shown on this display, Nanishuk A in the north, B in the middle, and C in the south. This targets the Nanishuk 3 and also some Alpine C reservoirs underlying it. The next point talks about the timing and volumes expected from our development activities. We continue to see EPS targeting the range of 30,000 barrels a day with first oil in late 2022, utilizing the backbone of the road system, which is the middle road out to the NDB pad location. Full-field development, we're targeting 135,000 barrels a day in early 2025 from the three well pads. We've elected to change the planned main first oil date from late 2024 to early 2025 for several key reasons, first being to align equipment purchase orders with our FID decision gate. The second is to realize a higher confidence of shipping fully complete modules in our sail away, so we minimize high-cost labor and tie-in risks on the slope. And finally, thirdly, to ensure that we have ease of tie-in or expansion for our future satellites, much like the Mitkook success for tie-in purposes. I'd like to make one other point before clearing this slide in terms of our project returns. We've shared previously that our break-even return on capital is about $45 per barrel for the project, which remains our current view. Additionally, our break-even cash cost is about $15 a barrel once we reach plateau. Another ancillary point is that for projects like Mitkook, where we build new drill sites that will ultimately tie back to facilities, they have a break-even cost of capital of around sub-30, around $27, $28 per barrel. So some compelling and robust economics for our project. Okay, moving on to our winter activities. This is the 2019-2020 winter season. As I mentioned, we've commenced our civil works. This includes gravel lay, bridge installation, and other gravel hauling activities. We're building out the infrastructure for this in service of both the early and main production periods. We're also doing a drilling program that includes two exploration wells. As you can see on that map, the Mitkuk is east of the Coropica area, and Stirrup is to the southwest, separated by some 150 kilometers of distance. The focus of this winter's program will include not only the road and pad to NDB, but also pads for our operations facility and also for our processing center. If the winter season allows, we'll consider additional scope running up towards our NDA pad. Just a few highlights for your interest. This is the largest gravel program undertaken in over 20 years on the North Slope. We're pulling from two mine sites, running over 40 trucks from one mine site and 25 trucks from the other site. It's a continuous operation activity. Additionally, for the drilling activities, we beat last year's record of spudding the earliest in 43 years with this year as well. And we've done this with exemplary safety and environmental performance. Just for clarity also, the EPS, the early production system, it utilizes a subset of wells, drill sites, facilities, and pipelines and roads that are required for a full development. It also helps us level our activity in anticipation of installation of the main facilities. Going into a bit more detail on the winter program, the Mitkuk 1 mother bore was drilled. We spudded that well in December 25th. The results have been previously disclosed and are included here with over 55 meters in net oil pay and 5 meters in net gas pay at the mother bore, and an additional 10 net meters in net oil pay and 6 meters in net gas pay in the underlying Alpine C interval. It's interesting to note that the gas encountered aids our future needs for fuel and also can help with our enhanced oil recovery needs. We've then, after completing the mother bore, logging and acquiring that information, we sidetracked to the about 500 meters away and encountered the same Nanushuk 9 reservoir. We're currently undergoing evaluation of that zone and have mobilized for completion and testing activities. The final point under that is that it's about 10 kilometers from our planned central processing facility, so it represents a relatively straightforward tieback opportunity. At Stirrup, we spudded the well about a month later, and this is because it required a more extensive ice road to reach that location. We intersected the Nanushuk 90, and we've encountered hydrocarbon shows. Currently, we're coring, logging, and evaluating the zone of interest. However, we have seen enough encouragement that supports a well test decision, so we are mobilizing to undertake that. Okay. So what are the implications of Mitkuk? This slide is quite involved. I'd like to point first to the map. If you look at the map, the Kuparuk River unit, the large field to the east, and then the Alpine field to the west represent the eastern and western boundaries, respectively, of our acreage, which lies in between with the Pika field. You can see the Nanushuk play fairway highlighted. Additionally, there's an AA prime line that indicates a cross-section, and a schematic of that cross-section is shown at the bottom of the display. It runs from west to east. So you can see the willow and other topset plays to the far west. You can see where our projected horseshoe block lies with the Stirrup well location. Then moving east, you come into our Nanushuk 2 and Nanushuk 3 sequences that comprise the main Pika field. So we number each of these topset intervals from west to east. Moving further east, the orange color ones identify prospective zones of interest, showing the NAN 5, NAN 6, and NAN 7 zones before you get over to Mitkuk, which is actually a NAN 9 interval. So the point I'd like to make is that we see a rich set of opportunities within the field bounds of our project. Additionally, you can see the colors on the Mitkuk accumulation show oil with over over gas over top, as it does in the alpine below, which again can help meet our fuel and EOR needs for the future. So we see a really exciting set of opportunities that can be bringing high value accretive benefit to the project. So with that, I'd like to hand it back to Kieran to discuss the strategic review. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Bruce. Yeah, the Alaska operations is really a stellar success for Oil Search, and you'll see more and more on that as we go forward. Just really want to finish up with our strategic review, which you'll see more of in the third quarter this year. But importantly, the board has initiated a major corporate strategic review to set a 10-year plan for the company, focus on ensuring we have the capacity to deliver the risk-reward value of our assets in PNG and Alaska, and also ensures that we have a sustainable long-term business in PNG that actually evolves with the country dynamics, and that we fully consider global trends and investor market desires to position Oil Search as a partner and investment of choice for all stakeholders. The last time Oil Search undertook such a comprehensive review was back in 2002, when the initiatives that were set at the time had really led to the successful company that we are today. We have engaged the services of Bain, Goldman Sachs and other specialists to work with the dedicated Oil Search team in this process. The review will be completed, as I said, in early third quarter, with the intention to present them to the market and investors at an investor day in early September. To ensure we develop a long-term strategy aligned with shareholders and interests, we'll also be arranging a number of meetings over the coming months with our shareholders and investors to listen to and collate views and opinions for our consideration. Regarding how we currently see the world, it really is Oil Search does have, despite the economic gloom that we're seeing in the world at the moment with the coronavirus, we have an incredibly robust position today and an outstanding platform to deliver long-term shareholder value. We've got world-class producing assets in PNG and LNG, and the LNG expansion really does have a niche play and a niche opportunity for the North Asian markets. We've got material Alaskan oil assets that are very, very close to infrastructure with low break-even and development costs with major growth potential. We have sound operating cash flow and liquidity position underpinned by an increasingly disciplined capital allocation. Oil Search also has an industry-leading reputation for social responsibility. We have over 80% of our PNG workforce comprising of PNG citizens. We recently signed a landmark use agreement in Alaska that supports sustainable future and cultural preservations for all future generations. And we've been recognised independently as a top quartile of carbon trackers, climate resilient oil and gas companies. But the world is definitely changing. Energy and transition has a clear direction of travel, but at a highly uncertain pace, creating opportunities and challenges. The socio-political landscape is evolving more quickly than companies can actually prepare for. Companies are also facing greater societal expectations than ever before. But importantly, we're very well placed to be able to lead the pack with respect to that. In regard to the strategic review, the company-wide strategic review will actually reevaluate Oil Search's long-term vision, our strategic focus, and our path for delivering superior shareholder returns. We'll establish how we evolve with PNG and how we proactively manage risk to deliver the PNG assets full potential. We'll ensure sustainable, environmentally responsible and profitable operations through a flawless project execution. And we'll also consider Oil Search's position in the global energy business and how it respond to technological changes and ESG considerations. It's an area that we intend to be very tangibly at the leading forefront of. Importantly, this review will not distract Oil Search's focus on safe, reliable operations, nor will it focus on delivering our key projects in PNG, Alaska. It will not change our focus on being a lowest quartile cost provider for our projects, nor will it change our focus on being very responsible with respect to capital management. It won't also compromise our Oil Search's DNA of social and environmental responsibility. In fact, we intend to enhance it. So in final, I'll just go through where we are looking forward to into 2020. In summary, times are uncertain across so many areas, but we're working to focus our business and make our company a leader in regard to alignment with stakeholders, whether they be our loyal investors, our JV partners, host governments, and equally importantly, the communities where we operate, or more broadly. Put simply, we are focused on five areas. Still, the highest priority in the company is commercialising and advancing our LNG expansion. focusing on a positive outcome for all parties. We're still targeting an optimal three-train expansion, and we welcome the ongoing dialogue with the PNG government and all parties involved. Our second priority is delivering the Alaskan Picker unit development optimally through incorporating and expanding our resource base, as Bruce went through, and also optimising our facilities to ensure that we minimise capital spend whilst maximising value. We're also quite advanced with respect to optimising equity, and we actually have a company up in Alaska right now doing some field due diligence. So it really is advancing. We have an FID decision in second half of 2020. It's our intention to be a model for social environmental responsibility, and we've established dedicated teams to develop material and measurable initiatives to minimise our footprint and emissions. It's an area where you hear so much, but you see so little tangible direction coming out of people. We also want to create a long-term business and development and support local community wellbeing. Whilst it's number four, it's probably number one in our terms of priorities in regard to capital management and prioritisation. We clearly have a focus on Picker unit and moving it towards feed, and we're focused on early commercialisation opportunities in both in PNG and Alaska. Discretionary expenditure, or expenditure that doesn't have a clear pathway to commercialisation, will be halted for the foreseeable future. Our strategic review is clearly going to set the long-term vision. It's a comprehensive strategic review, and it's already underway, and as I said, the results will be released in September. Delivering full value, capital management, investment allocation, consideration of the optimal mix of scale and assets, all searches position in the energy future, our funding, optimising operating model in PNG are all key aspects of the strategic review. With that, I thank you very much for your attention, and I'll actually throw it open for questions. James, how did I know that you're always going to be first?
Thanks, Kieran. Okay, a couple of questions. Firstly, congratulations on the appointment, by the way, Kieran.
Thank you.
So I love I'm reading into the release too much, but I actually got the impression from the language in the release that you were more optimistic on a PNG deal being done than you might have been a month ago, using words like once PNG is signed as opposed to if PNG is signed, including the costs in your CapEx guidance, for example. I'm wondering, over the past month, as you've had these informal discussions, do you think the balance of probabilities of a deal being done is something that you're more optimistic on?
Look, it's a good question, one that we anticipated. You know, the reality is that there's a huge amount of value in an integrated three-train project for all parties, and that really has to be the focus of it for the project proponents. So what we're looking to do is to ensure that every avenue of pursuing that project and that integration is pursued. So hence Peter and Beth are up in PNG at the moment. But apart from that, I'm really going to say very little. And you can also see that both Exxon and Total have publicly stated that their intention is to pursue a three-train development. So whilst the formal negotiations, you know, were suspended at the end of January, it was clear that there was potential space for the parties to reach an agreement, and it's in that space that we're trying to achieve.
Okay. Do you think in the absence of a timeline that actually makes it easier to come up with a compromise between the JV and the PNG government?
Look, it's a good question. You know, when you negotiate things that have a 30 or 40 year time frame that impact a lot of people's lives over multiple generations, you want to make sure that you get it right and that you get it right for all parties. So one of the benefits, you know, which one of the few benefits of the slowdown economically is it's actually given space a rational discussion, you know, between all the parties, and that's where we're focused on at the moment.
Okay, I wanted to ask quickly about AGX. Mm-hmm. Now, I presume that pre-feed would have continued despite the fact that the PNG gas agreement had stalled. Is the AGX feed entry predicated on also entering feed for expansion more generally? And really, the crux of my question here is trying to understand whether AGX could actually be used to debottleneck the existing two trains, because the share price reaction a month ago effectively eliminated all the value for Train 3, but didn't necessarily add back any value for your gas resource being able to debottleneck the existing trains.
Okay, to answer the first question first with respect to AGX and feed, AGX feed is dependent on PNG going ahead at this stage. One of the other issues that we saw was that there was a substantial increase in gas resources that was announced last year, so the project's not short on gas resources. But at the moment, the AGX project, progressing that, you know, through to FEED is really dependent on PNG.
Okay. Would in the instance, though, that PNG gas agreement was unsuccessful, do you see a pathway to being able to debottleneck the existing trains, whether that's through the lens of technically being able to debottleneck or commercially arranging the gas to go into a larger two-train?
Look, I mean, we're very fortunate to have Exxon as an operator, and Exxon has been very successful in maximising the value and throughput through the existing trains, and I'm sure that will be a consideration of how we continue to maintain value for all parties. But at the moment, as I said, we're very, very focused on exploring all opportunities to pursue the three trains because it makes sense for everyone.
Got it. All right, I might leave it there. Thanks, Kieran.
Tim Gerard from Janus Henderson. With regard to Alaska, I noticed in the last ConocoPhillips report, they are also looking to sell down their acreage to the east, to the west around Willow. Does their timing of their sell down have any positive or negative impacts on your 15% sale?
Again, Tim, it's a good question. Also in their release, they talked about delaying their sale until they actually get clarity on some of the citizens' ballot initiatives in Alaska in relation to taxing some of the legacy fields, because their 15% also includes some of the legacy field areas. So the reality is it doesn't impact us with respect to timing. Conoco have their own reasons for it, but they've talked about limiting their capital expenditure to a certain limit. That's why they're looking at divesting up to 25%. But having said that, Alaska still accounts for, I think this year, upwards of 50% of their allocation for expenditure, which highlights just how serious all of us are seeing this management play in the area.
But you wouldn't see any opportunity for a single party sort of buying both stakes?
There's always that avenue. At the moment, one of the things that we've learnt is to have our hands on our own levers, to make sure that we're not reliant on other parties for the successful delivery of value to our shareholders. So right now we're very focused on a simple 15% divestment, and we've had a lot of interest.
Thank you.
Okay, if there's no more questions in the room, if people on the ether or on the phone would like to ask a question.
Thank you. Your first question comes from Daniel Butcher from CLSA. Please go ahead.
Hi, everyone. A couple of questions. Just on the Alaska sell down, if the market price is not right at the time, would you warehouse a 51% until a year or two down the track? And how does that sort of interact with your LNG expansion plans and financing? Thanks.
Okay, Dan, it's a good question. It's not one that we haven't thought about, nor one that's been asked before. It's strongly our intention at the moment. We're seeing strong interest to divest our 15%. It's not a change. We moved last year and moved the divestment into this year to take into consideration the Pikka B and Pikka C results and also the expected resource upgrade that was confirmed by the Ryder Scott independent certification. It's our intention, really, to continue with the divestment. However, one of the interesting things about the Mid-Corp result, it really has highlighted that there is substantial additional potential in the area that can be rapidly tied in. It's still early days. The wells are still operational, and we're still mobilising. We're just in the process of mobilising testing equipment to both well sites. But at this stage, it's our intention to continue with the divestment to a 35% level. If we were to make that decision, it would be a decision that we'd make following the completion of the review of the Mid-Corp results and also understanding exactly where the likelihood of the PNG expansion occurs, and that's still a couple of months away.
Okay, thanks. And maybe just moving to the Stirrup result, I mean, you mentioned you had oil shows that obviously very preliminary. Can you maybe, this is slightly simplistic, but maybe give us an idea of what minimum flow rate you'd like to see in the test in March, April, to sort of indicate prospectivity and worth drilling it further?
Look, the key issue here is that the testing will be done on a single zone with a single stimulation, so it won't be really indicative. The important point about that test will really be that we get oil recovered to surface at a reasonable rate. We're not expecting thousands of barrels, you know, given the constraint of the testing equipment, but you know, we'll give you a very clear indication once we get the test results whether it's positive or not. But you'll probably be best to leave it there.
Sure, okay. I'm just curious, finally, I mean, maybe it's nitpicking here, but you clearly signal your intention to focus on the three-train development when you meet the JV in the next month or two. But will just alternatives also be discussed, like going ahead with Papua on its own? I'm just wondering if that option does come down to that in the future, might you need to bring Santos into Elk Antelope, given it has veto over the foundation project?
There's a lot of hypotheses there that we actually don't control there, Dan. Look, the reality is that all of the parties recognise the value that's associated with the three-train expansion for PNG and for the stakeholders, and especially the importance of driving costs as low as possible in the current economic climate. So at the moment, we're very, very focused on that outcome. You know, clearly, at some stage in the future, if all of those things are exhausted, we'll actually relook at the Papua LNG, but at the moment, the joint venture is very focused on a three-train outcome. So anything other than that's hypothetical.
All right, thanks. I'll leave it at that. Cheers.
Your next question comes from Saul Kavanovic from Credit Suisse. Please go ahead.
Hi, Kieran. Congratulations again on the new role. A couple of questions, if I may. If I start on PNG expansion and acknowledging what you say that it's a hypothetical, anything other than the three-train expansion. I'm guess since that's a hypothetical, I mean, what was the rationale for Oil Search's announcement to shift focus to Papua on the 3rd of February, and what has changed since then? And if I just also may ask a question about contractors, I mean, there's obviously talk in the market about the EPC contractors and their availability to build PNG expansion. Are those bodies still being held back and being kept warm, being able to execute should Penang enter feed? Or at what point or have we already seen, you know, those people move off onto other projects around the world?
Yeah, hi, Solomon. Thanks for your congratulations. It's appreciated. I'll deal with your second question first. Having just come out of Japan last week with Diego and our marketing team, we actually caught up with Chiyoda whilst we were there, and they're still very focused and committed to supporting feed for the Penang project. So to answer that question, you know, there is still a commitment and an intention, you know, to sort of drive that project going forward with the existing contractors there. With respect to your first question about what's changed in the last month, not a lot, apart from the fact that there's been an ability to step away from something with a specific time frame and look at continually what's in the best interest of all the parties. And what's very clear is that a three-train project is in the interest of all parties, as I've said before. And so that is the focus for all, everyone, especially when you look at, you know, the global economic environment, where PNG sits relative to the market, its costs and such. So we believe that there is the potential to have an opportunity for reaching agreement, and that there is potential deal space between the parties. So that's where we need to focus our attention right now.
Thanks. My second question is on Alaska, and particularly the delay of the full scale development startup from 24 to 25. Now, if I just rewind back to when the Alaska entry happened, and I think you were guiding to a 23 startup for the whole development, subsequent to that, you've obviously cited optimization to get to where we are now, but I'm struggling to see how an optimization results in 1 year early production for the early production section, but a 2 year delay to the full scale production. I mean, have there also just been fundamental delays here for other reasons beyond optimization compared to your entry case into Alaska?
Again, so it's a good question. 2023 was the estimate that when we acquired the asset was the estimate from Repsol and Armstrong. So, you know, we obviously went with what was originally proposed by those parties. When we got into the asset, it was quite clear that the area needed to be further appraised and confirmed by the drilling that we did, and also, you know, some of the information that we were able to share with adjacent operators. So very early on, we made a clear decision, and we advised the market that we'd be moving to a 2024 full field development and potentially looking at an early production system where we could not only get early cash flow in 2022, but where we could also use the early activity to drive cost benefits through drilling and others into the overall project development, given the fact that about a third or a little bit over a third of the actual cost of the project are drilling related. So there was a lot of rationale in terms of why we did what we did, because the scale of the drilling here is that we really wanted to get it right. With respect to the current change, one of the other issues that we wanted to make sure is that especially with the increase in resources, that we control our own destiny for expansion volumes as much as possible. And so, you know, part of this is to be making sure that in terms of any commercial negotiations or discussions with other parties, we have an ability to add reserves over a period of time that's not discretionary and not reliant on other parties' involvements or other parties' decisions. So, you know, whilst it's a relatively short delay, it actually provides also with a lot more leverage and control over its own destiny, and that there's a lot of rationale and economic justification behind it.
Understood, Kieran. Good answer. A quick follow-up on that. The entry into feed, does that confirm that there's commercial arrangements to share neighbouring infrastructure have been concluded, or are they still outstanding?
We're very, very close. You know, the financial arrangements are largely finalised, and we're just completing some of the outstanding sort of legal issues at the moment, but it's very close. You know, early production is in the interest of all parties, you know, in the interest of our joint venture, and it's also in the interest of ConocoPhillips at Kuparuk. So, you know, we're very confident that there will be an agreement made in the not-too-distant future, but the joint venture has moved forward with all the engineering and support for engineering feed, and we're progressing with Worley Parsons and other contractors to achieve the dates that we've mentioned in the release.
Thanks. Lastly, on the LNG marketing, having just come back from Japan, and talking about PNG LNG's LNG being differentiated because it's rich. Now, I think we're aware, you know, that was very much the market mantra 10 years ago. But at least according to my conversations with market participants, I'm not aware of any recent contracts for LNG where rich LNG has achieved a premium, or indeed it may have actually be achieving discounts given some of the operational challenges involved. Do you actually expect to have a differentiated product because of the rich LNG? Are you aware of any contracts where that is actually being reflected in the pricing that have been conducted over the last few years?
Again, fairly interrogative question, Sol. Look, importantly, we don't comment on other people's pricing or mechanisms for entry. I suppose the most important point about the high heating value is if you look at the number of contracts that are winding down out of Japan, you know, coming out of the Northwest Shelf and other areas which are high heating value, you know, all searches and the group's LNG out of Papua New Guinea is very well placed to replace those volumes. So that's probably best left there.
Thanks, Kieran. And apologies, I can just squeeze one last one. On the strategic review, do you envisage that could incorporate looking at M&A beyond Alaska and PNG?
Look, the important point, the board has, as Rick said at one of Peter's recent farewells, you know, the board has told us to be brave and consider, you know, all different options. But having said that, one of the things that was absolutely paramount here is that nothing in the strategic review will remove our focus on delivering the core assets in PNG and Alaska. So we won't be doing anything to compromise the delivery of those. So, you know, it's a politician's answer to say, there's always a possibility, but right now we're focused on delivering the full potential of our core assets.
Perfect. Thanks, Kieran. And I think you've dealt with my interrogative questions quite deftly.
Your next question comes from Mark Semter from MST. Please go ahead.
Morning, guys. Just a quick question, Kieran, a bit of a follow-up one from Dan on the sell-down with Alaska. And obviously, macro's a bit ugly at the moment. maybe it becomes not the best time to sell this stake, no matter how valuable you ultimately think it is. Should we think FID is no longer contingent on the sell down? You would be happy now to FID at 51%? You know, should the macro make this the wrong time to sell down, or you want to get this deal done before FID?
No, I think the reality is our ability to finance at 51%. It's the intention to continue FID, and you have to make a lot of decisions during FEED in terms of contracting others, to drive the project forward. And where we could delay an FID decision simply on oil searches, push for a 35% partner. I'm not sure whether our partner would be too pleased with that. So it's certainly our intention to progress to FID in the last quarter this year. Whether or not we keep 51% will be determined by a number of factors, but at the moment it is our strong intention to divest, and we've actually seen, as I said, a number of very interested parties, and as I said, one's right up in the North Slope, probably not so much enjoying themselves at minus 50 degrees, whatever it is today. But it's strongly our intention to move forward with the divestment at 35% ongoing interest.
Great. Thanks, Chris.
Your next question comes from James Redfern from Bank of America Securities. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Kieran. Good afternoon. Just two quick questions, please. Just maybe first, cheeky one maybe, just in terms of the recent departure of Ian Munro, who is mainly responsible for gas marketing, is his departure related to, the delay in PNG around the expansion, or is it more a case of simplifying the organisational structure? I've got one more, thank you.
Yes. One of the things that we did, we looked at how to optimise the organisation going forward, and it was quite clear that we wanted to push more responsibility for gas marketing into the region. And so we've substantially upgraded the responsibilities and accountabilities of our Japan marketing office, and within a certain period of time we'll probably be opening a Singapore office to manage both our oil and our gas marketing out of that. So it really is a reflection of an evolution and maturing of Oil Search's organisation, and we're lucky to have Diego to be in charge of that corporately, and Diego's got a strong background in marketing through his previous role with Exxon. So it was simply a matter of optimising the executive structure.
Okay, thank you. And then just a quick one on the potential sell down in Alaska. During the site visit last year, it was suggested that some of the Japanese trading houses might be interested in farming into the picker unit. Is that still the case, or should we be thinking more about some of the other EMPs operating in Alaska at the moment? Thank you.
No, it's a good question, but it's a combination of both. And so there's nothing different to what we talked about last year during the field visit, I'm pleased to say.
Okay, great. Thanks, Kieran.
Your next question comes from Adrian Prendergast from Morgans Financial. Please go ahead.
Thanks, Kieran. Just one quick follow-up question on the informal talks at Pyongyang. And just really, what indication can you give us, if any, on just how far apart the two sides are? Like, is it as simple as needing to reach a consensus on some sort of price, or is it something more material around the government seeking to transform the fiscal model?
Yeah, Adrian, I'm pleased to say you've given me the easiest question so far. Look, I really can't discuss anything in relation to the discussions that may be occurring or what they're actually talking about. We're not the operator of the project, and Oil Search's role is just really to make sure that discussions are ongoing. So I'll leave it there before I get in trouble.
Fair enough. And just one quick follow-up one, just back to the scope of the strategic review. Is it, in addition to, as you said, that the board have charged you with being bold and looking at all sorts of growth options that don't disrupt PNG and Alaska, but really just honing in on PNG and Alaska, is it also around the emphasis on the two in terms of comfortability with the spread between them, or is it really just down to ultimately optimising what you've got in front of you in the current portfolio?
Again, it's an easy question to answer. It's about value for our shareholders and the speed at which we can commercialise and capital optimisation. So You know, one of the things that we see in Alaska is we see a lot of running room, you know, for additional growth. But importantly, what we don't want to be doing is in Alaska is, you know, drilling wells that have aren't going to be commercialized for the next 5, 10+ years. So for us in Alaska, it's all about identifying opportunities to tie into existing facilities to either expand or to grow the production base in Alaska quite quickly. In PNG, it's about making sure we deliver on our LNG expansion volumes as optimally for everyone as possible. We don't need to be out there drilling any more gas wells. Peter's talked very clearly and told the market that's not our intention to drill any more expensive wells that don't see a market for, you know, for into the next decade, and that's strongly the case. So we're in a situation now where we're very able to manage our portfolio and focus capital where it's, you know, not only most needed, but where it actually adds the best value for our shareholders. And in PNG, we don't have, as I said in the presentation, we don't have a lot of ongoing commitments.
Great. Thanks, Kieran. My other question has been answered. Cheers.
There are no further questions at this time. I'll now hand back to Mr. Wolfe.
Okay. Look, with that, I'd just like to thank everyone for coming. And I know it's a long time, and I know that the Caltech's presentation is today. So, look, thank you very much, and I look forward to a long relationship with all of you. So thank you for your support of Allsearch today. Thank you.